It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the World Health Organization released a report on adolescent health worldwide with serious concerns about things like depression, suicide, and traffic accidents. An expert explains the report's findings and how we can improve teen health.
Our next guest has been called a female Indiana Jones. She spends a lot of time on expedition in Africa and the island of Madagascar. Along the way, she discovered the mouse lemur, created a gorilla sanctuary, and journeyed through jungles to work with the animals she loves.
She's exploring Wisconsin next Tuesday, May 20th. She'll talk about her wildlife at the Overture Center in Madison.
Mireya Mayer joins us now. She's a primatologist, explorer, and a correspondent for National Geographic TV. She's also the author of the book called Pink Boots and a Machete. Mireya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've had an incredible career. Can you tell us how you went from being kind of a city girl from the States to an explorer who lives for months at a time in the jungle working with wildlife?
Well, I think it shocked my very overprotective Cuban parents because I did grow up in this big city and, you know, really there wasn't the opportunity to embrace nature maybe the way that I would envision an explorer doing. But I always loved animals as a kid, and I was extremely adventurous, constantly climbing trees and jumping off rooftops and all sorts of things. So it's not quite a shock to me that I ended up in this field, but it was a divergence. I mean, not only was I a city kid, I was an NFL cheerleader for the Miami Dolphins. So again, not exactly what you'd imagine Indiana Jones doing in his spare time.
Right. So you got from there to Africa. You became a primatologist. How did that happen?
Well, I was in college at the University of Miami, and I took an anthropology course as a science requirement, but I was actually in pre-law. And I fell in love with the subject, and when I learned about how many endangered primates there were on the verge of extinction and we knew nothing about them, I decided that I wanted to do something about it. And I literally, within 2 months of making that decision, found myself in one of the most unexplored, most remote areas of South America, hacking through Amazon rainforest.
Mm. Wow. Well, we're going to move around because you've had such an interesting career working with all kinds of different animals. I want to talk about the lemurs of Madagascar because you have a special place in your heart for them. What first drew you to them, and when did you first start working with them?
Well, Madagascar's lemurs have just been named the most endangered animal on the planet. And when I first started working with them, we knew how rare they were, that they were on the verge of extinction. And all I could find were line drawings of some of these animals. There weren't even photographs in existence. So I decided that I wanted to go and be the first person to study some of these unknown species. And when I got to Madagascar, I just fell in love with the people, the wildlife there. And really, it just became a second home.
Mm. And you made a special discovery, the mouse lemur, I think it's called.
That's right. It's the world's smallest primate, and I discovered it with my colleague, Dr. Ed Lewis. And it weighs less than 2 ounces and fits in the size of your palm. And I always like to say that most of those 2 ounces is eyes. I mean, they have these huge, incredible big eyes and this tiny little body, and they're just phenomenal animals.
So what needs to be done for lemur conservation? You said they're among the most endangered species. What are you hoping will happen?
Well, one of the things that threatens the lemurs, or the main thing, is deforestation. And I think just raising awareness, even an interview like this or going to the Overture Center and talking about their plight is incredibly meaningful for the island of Madagascar, just raising awareness. You know, people make choices every day that impact not just locally, but globally, you know, whether it's the products they buy, the wood materials they use. And that's something that's very important to the lemurs of Madagascar.
You've said that when you get off the plane in Africa, that it just feels like home to you. How do you explain that sense of familiarity that you have there?
It was the strangest sensation. I remember stepping off the plane, and something about the sights and the sounds and even the smells was just very familiar. And the people in Madagascar are incredibly welcoming and friendly and generous. And it was almost as if I was stepping into, you know, distant relatives' homes. when I first arrived there. You know, I was 20-odd years old. You know, this is now, I guess, 15 years ago was the first time I went there. And what was supposed to be a three-month project ended up being 10 months at a time for years and years. I just suddenly felt very at home in this very exotic land.
And you've been lucky enough to do a lot of your work there, and you've worked with, you know, animals that are not very threatening, like lemurs, but you've also had some kind of close shaves with animals out there in the wild. Can you tell us about one of the more difficult situations you've come across?
No, I've been very fortunate in my career. Yes, I spent many years working in Madagascar and continue to do so, but I became a National Geographic explorer and correspondent making wildlife documentaries. And I remember the first time they asked me, would you feel comfortable talking about other animals on camera? And I probably knew little at the time, but I said yes, because I love the idea of being able to work with animals such as leopards and giraffes and sharks and, you know, giant humboldt squid. And I got to do all of this. And I certainly have had very close encounters, for example, with gorillas, you know, 450-pound silverback charging you. You know, gives you a rush every time, no matter how many times.
Wait, you know, being it's happened more than once by you?
It's happened more times than I can possibly count.
Oh my gosh.
You know, being chased by forest elephants, you know, coming across and almost stepping on venomous snakes is, I should have been a herpetologist because I have a knack for finding the most dangerous snakes on the planet. So there's certainly been some close calls, and I've nearly died in the field of other things. I say the most dangerous animal in the field is a mosquito, which most people don't think about when they think about dangerous creatures. But of course, they carry malaria, which is so deadly in so many parts of this world. Mm. And I've had the fortune of encountering that, too.
Okay, well, I got to ask. So I hope it never happens to me, but what do you do when you're charged by a 400-pound silverback gorilla?
You do the most difficult, counterintuitive thing there is, which is to remain perfectly calm and still. And actually, the best thing to do is to act like a gorilla and become submissive as if you're part of the group. And so generally, I cower down, you know, so that they don't feel intimidated by size and they feel as big as they are, and pretend to eat plants, which is what they do in an aggressive situation. So you basically, you want to become one with the gorilla in that case.
Oh, wow. Well, that's not what I would have expected. I would have expected run like crazy, but yeah.
No, the last thing you want to do is run. But on the other hand, with forest elephants, which are quite agile and limber for their size, you do want to run and climb up a tree if possible.
Wow. Well, a lot has been made about the fact that, you know, you're obviously you're a woman doing this job and you're out there in the jungle. You're fending with, you know, poisonous snakes and being charged by elephants. And a lot of times people don't think of women as being the ones in the field doing this kind of work. What words of encouragement would you say to young women out there who might want to do a career like this one?
I say if you want to do it, if you can dream it, go for it. You know, for me, I had a lot of people say, you know, that it's a crazy idea, you shouldn't do it, it's dangerous. I have had the time of my life doing what I do, and I really do believe that anything that you can envision doing is possible. The truth is that there are a lot of women that are doing what I do, and we're not very well represented, say, at the televisual forefront. You know, we usually picture khaki-clad men with British accents, you know, in the field wrestling alligators and that sort of thing. But the truth is that there are many women out in the field every single day doing what I do.
I know a big part of your mission is conservation. What do you hope that your work accomplishes as far as conservation goes?
Well, I would say, yes, that the biggest mission for me is conservation, you know, raising that awareness, letting people know that there's all these amazing places and animals that are on the verge of extinction, and really trying to bring people through the media and through communication efforts to these places when they can't leave, you know, their own homes, and just bringing that beauty, that magnificence, that wonder to them.
Well, Maria,
and my hope,
oh,
of
sure,
course,
go ahead.
Is that people will care. No, I mean, my hope is that people will care and make an effort to help preserve these places and animals.
Maria, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoy Madison.
My pleasure, and I can't wait. Thank you so much.
That was Maria Mayor, primatologist, explorer, and a correspondent for National Geographic TV. She's the author of Pink Boots and a Machete.
Today, the World Health Organization released its Health for the World's Adolescents report. It shows that depression is a top cause of illness and disability for both boys and girls aged 10 to 19. Globally, the top three causes of adolescent death are road traffic injuries, HIV/AIDS, and suicide.
Elizabeth Sawick is with us to talk about the report and the organization's recommendations. She's a professor of nursing and adolescent medicine at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Well, this is a huge report that's just been compiled. How did the World Health Organization gather all this data?
So this is actually the product of more than a year, and it's something a little bit different. It's not a huge, like, yellow pages worth of a tome of report that you can actually get printed. It's online, and it's interactive. So there's the key messages, and then you can click on additional links to get videos and pop-up information. This was a huge consultation. So not only were there a variety of systematic reviews of the latest evidence from published research, all of the different guidance and recommendations that WHO has put out in all their various aspects. So the stuff related to HIV, the stuff related to reproductive health, the stuff that relates to tobacco use that have some aspect of adolescence related to it. But they also included drawing on some of the latest data, such as the mortality data that you mentioned at the beginning here, and the latest information about causes of disability and illness, and health behaviors from all the different countries in the world that actually do population surveys and have data that can be shared. And then on top of that, they also did a consultation with young people around the world in several different languages online using SurveyMonkey, and asked them their opinions about their health and well-being where they are. And they included those comments as well as a similar consultation with healthcare providers from 80 different countries in the world and their perspectives on adolescent healthcare into this report. So it's thousands and thousands of different people contributing to the perspective on this second decade of life, adolescence, age 10 to 19.
And I understand part of the reason for this report, or what the World Health Organization is hoping will come from it, is a new attention drawn to the problems, the health problems of adolescents, that this has maybe been overlooked for a while.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why adolescent health has kind of been neglected in comparison with the health of other age groups in the population. You know, one is they're perceived to be healthy and that their health problems are frequently hidden, because most of the ways that we actually collect the statistics about health problems don't separate out adolescents. They also happen to be that middle group where technically they're in pediatrics, but most pediatricians focus on babies and that early childhood, you know, the checkups and immunizations that you get before you start school. And some of their health issues are very much related to adults. But again, they're not usually the ones giving birth. It's a small subset of the population who are perhaps pregnant or who are engaging in work and things like that. And so they get missed in some of the ways that we do those statistics. They're also not a strong political constituency because they don't get to vote. Hmm. And even though, ironically, they're an important commercial market and they're a focus of a lot of targeted advertising. The other thing is that many of the issues that affect the health of adolescents are not really simple to address, such as some of the important causes of mother and child mortality, like pneumonia or problems with childbirth or malaria, where there's been a lot of focus on those interventions in other parts of the world. And finally, some of the issues that confront adolescents, like alcohol use or sexual health, are kind of culturally or politically sensitive. And there are a lot of opinions that adults have about adolescence that may not be grounded in fact, but certainly are grounded in emotion. And so as a result, that kind of limits the attention that has been given.
Well, the report definitely covers a lot of ground. I guess one of the biggest headlines, if you will, from the report is the problem of mental health issues taking a big toll on adolescents. Can you talk about a bit what that encompasses and what it might lead to?
Right. Well, so many of the key mental health problems actually begin during the adolescent years. There's a realization that a lot of the mental illnesses that adults may struggle with are often have their onset during adolescence, as many as one in four. Likewise, what we find is that those contribute to the key causes of death and of illness and disability for adolescents. So depression is the leading cause of illness and disability, and disability, like years lost due to illness for adolescents, and suicide is the third leading cause of death worldwide. Of course, in the U.S. and Canada, suicide is actually up the list. It ranks number two, just after road traffic accidents.
Well, so I suppose the idea here is to get intervention early on and then maybe prevent some of these more dire outcomes later on.
Absolutely. And part of the issue is that although these are you know, large contributing effects, we don't have systems in place in most countries, whether they're low-income countries or even high-income countries like the US and Canada, where mental health services are regularly available for adolescents. So whether it's insurance issues or there's just not enough mental health care providers available, oftentimes young people who are struggling with depression or other kinds of health issues face wait times, or they face an inability to actually get the health care they need.
And one of the more surprising findings in the report is that HIV/AIDS is the number two cause of adolescent deaths worldwide. And it seems like this is the only age group in which the HIV rate is rising. What's happening there?
Yeah, this is something that really took us by surprise and actually, frankly, has got us a bit worried, because we've seen declines in HIV deaths over the last decade thanks to, you know, retroviral drugs, effective treatment, early testing. But in contrast, we're actually seeing an increase in deaths among adolescents due to HIV. Now, part of what we think is going on is that the perinatally acquired HIV, so that is women who are pregnant, who are HIV positive and give birth to a baby, and they're born with HIV, that those babies and children are getting treatment and are living into adolescence, where perhaps they may not have in the past. But something happens during the teen years where some those services and the health care that they may have been getting as babies and children is no longer available. And we think the stigma of HIV may be part of what's happening. But we're seeing that, in fact, this is predominantly in Africa, but it's also an issue that adolescents are not necessarily being tested and then having access to treatment.
And as we head into our look at the news, there is some good news from the report. Smoking is declining, and there's also been a decline in teen pregnancy. You talked a little bit about that. But are health campaigns targeting those behaviors responsible, do you think, for these declines?
I do think they have a definite impact. And one of the things that we've seen in analyzing the smoking trends across a number of different countries around the world, I think there's 158 countries that contributed data on smoking, and we had trend data for probably about 45, mostly in Europe and North America, is that those countries where adults' level of smoking is high also had higher rates of teens, and their declines were not necessarily as strong. So overall, the world is sort of getting the news that smoking's bad for you, and a lot of those campaigns are actually making a difference in terms of reducing smoking. We know that smoking, if you started as a teenager, you're much more likely to continue as an adult, and that has a huge health impact. So the decline in youth even taking up smoking is very good news for our health systems.
Well, we're talking right now with Elizabeth Sawick about a new World Health Organization report on adolescent health worldwide.
And we want to know what you think. What issues face teens in your community? Is mental health as big a problem in your area as it is apparently worldwide? What is your community doing to address adolescent health?
We're continuing our conversation now with Elizabeth Sawick of the University of British Columbia about the World Health Organization's new report on adolescent health.
We want to know what you think and want to hear your questions. The report focuses in large part on mental health issues. Do you think in your community mental health for teens is taken seriously? Is it an important issue? If you are a teen or a parent of teens or in the healthcare professions, what kind of issues are of concern for you when it comes to teenagers and their health? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
And Elizabeth, I want to zero in on one that I think hits home here in the United States and, you know, here in Wisconsin, of course, road traffic injuries, the top cause of death globally, certainly. That's a big number up there.
Yeah, I think it's an important, and for me, it surprises me that even in places that are extremely low income, where there aren't that many vehicles, young people are still dying from road injuries, more often as a pedestrian getting hit rather than in driving. But certainly all across the United States and Canada, road traffic accidents are the leading cause of death for adolescents. And part of that has to do with the inexperience of adolescents. You know, this is a skill that they're learning. And sometimes, depending, it also can be linked to alcohol and driving or the use of marijuana and driving. So unfortunately, one of the challenges when it comes to deaths is that car accidents can be lethal, especially when you have high speeds on rural highways. And so that often you're more likely to end up with deaths than with disabilities or injuries.
Now, part of the report is making recommendations. Are there specific recommendations that the World Health Organization is calling for, maybe specifically as regards these road injuries and deaths?
Well, there's a whole series of guidelines and guidances and recommendations that have come out in various other reports from the World Health Organization that are pulled together as part of this. So this report, because it's so big and it covers everything from policies that governments have around adolescent health to the health sector and the training that goes into healthcare providers providing care for adolescents, as well as the issues for adolescents generally in terms of leading causes of death. So the recommendations, they try to keep it to the top 10 big ones, are very broad in general, but within the report itself, there are all these links and information on key recommendations. And most of those relate to examples like what they call graduated licenses. So, for example, when adolescents first get their driver's license, there may be restrictions on how many people can be in the car with them, and whether or not they can drive after midnight or those kinds of things, as well as the sort of zero tolerance for any blood alcohol level until you get beyond the novice license and into a full driver's license, which may take a couple years.
Well, to focus in some more on the United States, what unique problems do you see facing the nation's teens here?
Well, I think I'm not sure how many unique problems, other than one of the things that's fairly big here in North America is that the fifth leading cause of death is actually interpersonal violence. Unlike some other parts of the world where other causes of death, leading causes might be suicide or even war in some places, and HIV, as was mentioned in Africa, interpersonal violence is a growing issue in the Americas, and that includes death from shooting and gun injuries, but also just generally that sort of violence exposure. So that's something that clearly is an issue that we need to pay attention to in adolescence. And we also, I think, one of the other big issues in terms of not death, but overall health that will have long-term health ramifications is the increase in obesity and the decrease in physical activity. So we see that the World Health recommendations are that adolescents should be getting up to 60 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity every day. So that means 60 minutes of activity that makes you breathe hard and sweat. And there are very few adolescents that get that much. And the numbers suggest, at least in the national surveys that we've been tracking, those numbers are declining in the U.S. So that, of course, is linked to obesity, but it's not just obesity. That kind of physical activity contributes to heart healthiness, to prevent heart disease and strokes later on in life. It can help prevent diabetes, and it can contribute to positive mental health.
So this is sort of a window of opportunity for adolescents to get active and contribute to their health later on down the road.
As well as for right now, yes.
So what sorts of things, looking at in terms of, you know, increased activity, healthier eating, are there things like that that are clear windows of opportunity for us to jump in there and do the right thing for adolescents and get them moving and eating right?
Absolutely. Clearly some of the recommendations in terms of what they're tracking, because these contribute to those chronic conditions, cancer, and other diseases, is making sure that youth get enough vegetables and fruits, those 5 servings a day. Very few adolescents in North America get enough fruits and vegetables. And reduce the amount of sugared beverages, whether that's soda pop or fruit juices, and increase instead, you know, water and milk and other things. But mostly just reducing soft drinks and increasing fruits and vegetables, increasing that physical activity, and encouraging young people to do the kinds of things that will actually promote positive mental health for them.
So overall, what sorts of trends does this report reveal? Is adolescent health getting better on a global scale, or is it a lot still to worry us here?
Well, it's tough to actually say on a global scale, because what we see is that there are so many variations across countries. In every region of the world, some countries are really high at some of the things we're worried about, like smoking and lack of physical activity, and the trends may actually be getting worse. In other areas, like bullying, the trends may be getting better. Smoking is going down pretty consistently across North America and Europe, but there are some countries where it's actually still on the increase, mostly in lower and middle income countries. So there's no one trend. Generally speaking, though, the adolescent years are the years with the lowest amount of death compared to any other age range. The challenge we see is that as the world has been working to reduce unnecessary deaths, things that can be prevented over the last couple decades, the group that has had the least progress in reducing that has been adolescents. There's been huge gains in child survival and definite improvements in survival among older adults. They're living longer and living healthier, but we see very few improvements, definite improvements, just very few when it comes to adolescents. So there's still more work that needs to be done.
Yeah, that's troubling. And is that all down to what you talked about earlier about how adolescents get overlooked, or is there something else going on?
I think it's primarily that they get overlooked. And I think one of the big things is that we don't necessarily involve them in the decisions and actions that influence their health. That's a really important thing, giving youth a voice in how to best improve their health and make sure that their environment and their relationships and their opportunities are what are going to actually help them have the best health for now and in the future.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That was Elizabeth Sewick, Professor of Nursing and Adolescent Medicine at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. In just a minute, we'll find out what ticks have been up to over the winter and what to watch out for this summer if you're outdoors.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsinites have a passion for euchre. While sheepshead and cribbage have their ardent fans in parts of the state, euchre seems to cross all of Wisconsin's geographical and cultural divides. WPR's Brianne Chasseau tells us the story of the simple but competitive game.
Good job.
He overtrumped.
Oh, well.
That's fun.
That's a try.
It was worth a try.
It was.
Full disclosure, I've never played euchre. That's why I'm at this brew pub, attending a Madison area euchre meetup. I'm here to learn about a game that many Wisconsinites know and love.
Yeah, we'll make hearts jump.
After watching the play for more than half an hour, a player invites me to try my hand at it. My first attempt at euchre, well, it didn't go so well.
Well, where is it?
Come on.
Woo! There it is.
I probably would have saved that ace, because that's a boss when it's not trump. That's highest.
So ace is highest when it's not trump.
Yeah.
Right, let's go another one.
My partner and I didn't pick up a single trick, but the second time, things changed. I owe that success to a supportive partner, good cards, and friendly opponents who wanted to help me learn.
Hey, we got them.
You got them all.
Got four.
What do you got
four?
Thanks,
good
guys.
Job.
Let me have it anyway. Nick Fouts organizes the Madison area euchre meetup. Later that week, he walked me through the basics and the lingo, things like trumps, tricks, and offsuits.
I don't want to say it's mostly luck, but there's very little, depending on how your cards are played, there's a lot, not a lot of like intense thought that has to go into it. There's a lot of just kind of, you know, going with whoever started, you follow along. So it's one of those games where you can play, you can pass time, at the same time you can still interact with the people without having to be entirely focused just on the game. So it's something really to kind of help people connect and do something while being able to have that medium to talk about other things at the same time.
Fouts grew up playing the game in Indiana. Here's the thing, euchre's not a Wisconsin-only game. However, folklorist Jim Leary notes that Wisconsinites have developed a passion for the game. He says people were madly playing it in the mid-19th century, and after that, it just stuck in some places.
It seems to be one of these things that just kind of got into the culture of the region in a lot of ways and just kept up kind of in the same way that the polka, which was a kind of an international fad throughout Europe in the 1840s and 1850s, has remained and kind of taken on a life of its own here in Wisconsin. So I think euchre kind of goes hand in hand with that in a way.
The state's passion for euchre can be found in south-central Wisconsin, where the Sugar River Euchre League plays. Ben Gobler is a member of the league, which he says started in 1931. Gobler played his first game of euchre in 1948 and became a captain in the Euchre League a few years later. In 1956, he began writing a euchre column for the local papers. It's something he still does today and includes who got a perfect score and sometimes who got skunked.
I just kept doing it, and now I can't quit, and I kept track of all the averages. A new member took over the averages, and now I just have to keep track of the won and lost records. And I play it, of course. I love to play it.
Thanks to good teachers, I now know the euchre basics. It's a mix of luck and skill. But what I enjoy most about euchre is that the game is about having fun and enjoying good company. I can't wait to play again.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. Their new TV series airs Monday nights at 8.
Well, believe it or not, summer is just around the corner, and that means a lot of us will be heading outside, and obviously that's cause for celebration, but there are tiny creatures out there looking to ruin our fun. Ticks.
2013 saw big tick populations around the state. What does this year have in store for us? Well, joining us now in the studio is Susan Paskowitz. She's professor of entomology at UW-Madison and kind of the go-to person for tick-related issues in the state. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we had a cold winter. That's not news to anyone. And I imagine a lot of people are hoping you'll tell them that the cold winter wiped out the ticks. It's not true, is it?
I wish that were the case. I really do. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that deer ticks in Wisconsin are probably pretty adapted to these kinds of cold winters. And so we had a lot of snow cover. I'm sure they're like nestled up under the snow and in the first couple inches of the leaf litter in the soil and fairly well protected. You know, we hadn't had a winter like this since the 1980s, I think, early 1980s. So I did go back through the records to see what I could figure out, whether we could get any clues from that. And there really wasn't anything there. So I'm afraid we will see deer ticks this year. And in fact, we have already seen them. We've been out in our own area as early as second week in April, and we were collecting, and we picked up 50 ticks in just a small area here in Madison. So,
and it seemed like we were hearing that tick populations were booming last year. What was behind that? And do we have reason to believe it could happen again?
Last year, I actually predicted it would be a really low tick year.
Uh-oh.
Because 2012 was such a dry year. Mm-hmm. You know, early on, things got going and we thought it was going to be bad, but then it dried out and the ticks really for us were very low that year. And I predicted that because they were low that year, that would have killed a bunch of them. And so it would suppress the population in 2013. But that's not what we saw. Actually, every single place that we visit in Wisconsin, and we have now about 10 to 15 different sites that we go to every year. All but one of those, there were 2 to 7 times as many ticks last year as there had been the year before. So I'm afraid it was a boom year then, and I don't know what that's going to mean yet for this year.
Well, we talk about this in large part because of the risk of disease, Lyme disease and others. What kind of things do we worry about with our Wisconsin ticks?
A couple of things. You know, we worry that the ticks actually are moving into new areas where people and the health practitioners are actually maybe not as aware. Of course, people who live in northwestern Wisconsin have known about Lyme risk for a really long time. They've been dealing with it since the 1980s. But we've done a number of surveys to look at the distribution in the state. Our most recent one was about 5 years ago. And when we compare where ticks were then with where they were back in the early 80s, it's a big difference. Now, much of the southern and eastern part of the state, where before we had a hard time finding them, if you have a wooded area, it's highly likely that they finally managed to invade those areas. So we worry about the ticks being in new areas. Another thing that we're seeing is as they're moving into the new areas, of course, over time, the infection rates in the ticks have been going up. And so where, you know, in the middle 1990s, maybe I was seeing 8 to 12% of ticks were infected. Now it's more like 20, 25%, all the way up to as many as 50 to 75% of the adults. So very high rates of infection for Lyme disease in those arthropods.
I remember in the last couple of years seeing national maps showing high Lyme disease areas, and I'm looking at these bright spots in the Northeast and a bright spot in Wisconsin. And why is Wisconsin such a Lyme disease area?
Right. Why are we a hot spot? That's mm-hmm. an excellent question, right? I think we have this excellent combination of the kinds of things that make these ticks happy. So they really like forests, right? Mm-hmm. They love forests. They require very high humidity to stay happy. They don't like open, sunny, agricultural kind of areas are not good. So you can imagine why Illinois and, you know, a lot of Iowa and other parts of the Midwest probably are not as good just in general as habitat. And then we have a lot of deer here, and deer are an important source of blood for the adult deer ticks, right? The nickname is deer tick, so it's obvious that that's one of the sources that they use in order to get blood and to make eggs. And we have lots of deer, so that probably contributes as well to a very large population here.
I wanted to talk briefly about a new kid on the block, this Lone Star tick. What can you tell us about this little guy?
Lone Star tick is really fascinating. I got interested in it a couple years ago because one of my colleagues who works at the Department of Public Health here in Madison mentioned that she had started hearing about patients who were getting a disease that's associated with the Lone Star tick. And this is a kind of ehrlichiosis, a new bacterial disease for us. And so a colleague of mine in entomology, Phil Pelletieri, who many of your listeners probably know about,
yeah.
and I put our heads together and we started collecting the records. Every time somebody from the public would talk to us or bring us a Lone Star tick, we began to map it. And interestingly, the media got wind of this last year, and so they were able to get the story out a little more broadly for me, and I got a lot of people submitting ticks. So Lone Star ticks came in last year. We had at least 14 confirmed records. I already have 3 confirmed records from this year. I was really hoping the winter was going to kill them, but it doesn't look like it. So we're seeing more. It's still quite a rare tick, but if anyone out there sees one, I'd be really interested in receiving that specimen.
Well, with our more common ticks, are there strategies that might help reduce the tick population or at least the disease population in those ticks?
You know, there are a number of things that scientists are testing right now to try to do that. You can certainly change your yard in some ways that make it less likely to be good habitat for the tick. The more open it is, I mean, that's a good thing. Put your children's play equipment right in the middle of a open grassy area rather than in the woods. That will help. We're also testing some methods right now that will target the small mammals and primarily the mice that are very important as reservoirs for the tick, for the Lyme disease, and also as host for the ticks. And so what you do here is you take some cotton balls, you treat it with an insecticide, the mice use it to make a nest out of, and then they essentially get a dose of insecticide on their fur, which then kills any ticks that attach to those mice. So we're going to test that this year and see if that's something that maybe some homeowners could use, at least on a small scale.
Now, when we go out for that walk in the woods, what are the best ways to not pick up a tick?
The best way is to stay in the middle of a hard packed trail and not go off to the sides and brush up against the vegetation, because a lot of times the ticks are kind of lurking there on the grass or on the small shrubs and waiting for you to pass by, and then they'll grab onto you. Another thing that we always do when my team and I go out is we do tuck our pants into our socks, or else we wear rubber knee boots. And that, you know, when it's hot, is kind of a difficult thing to do, but that can help to protect as well, especially if you're out there like clearing brush or something. That could be a really good measure that you might want to take.
And if we spot a tick on ourselves and we're doing our tick checks when we come in from the woods, what are you supposed to do then?
Well, you should remove the tick as quickly as possible, right? So you want to get some forceps or tweezers, get close down to where the tick is actually embedded on your skin, and then exert gentle backward pressure. So you don't want to rip it out too fast, because you don't want to leave the mouth parts in your skin, and you also don't want to force the contents of the tick's guts into your system. So you want to get the tick out. And then in Wisconsin, actually, if that tick had been on you for at least 36 hours, you should now go to your doctor and get a prophylactic treatment. You should get antibiotic kind of to protect yourself regardless of whether you have symptoms or not.
We'll leave it with that advice. Susan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Susan Paskowitz has been with us. She's a professor of entomology at UW-Madison.